I think many of us are already quite full, probably, with what God has spoken into our hearts. But I'm really trusting that the things that I'll be sharing are truly complementary to what the Spirit wants to do with us in this time that we've had together. The title of what I'm going to be talking about really is a kind of continuation of what we heard yesterday morning from Doug Stringer. I was so blessed with what he shared and just so inspired by the stories and the testimonies that came forward. That title is Repairs of the Breach, the Church is a Catalyst for Healing Communities. And it's based out of Isaiah 58:12 that says, "And your ancient ruins shall be rebuilt. You shall raise up the foundations of many generations. You shall be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of streets to dwell in." It's a beautiful promise. And for me, these verses have taken on a very personal and very practical meaning. Many of you know that in October of 2017, Sonoma County and this city that you're in right now, of Santa Rosa, were impacted by historic, devastating wildfires. At the time, the most destructive wildfire in California history and the number six most destructive wildfire in California history were both burning in this area at the same time. Either one of them by themselves would have been historic, but together they did something that really in California we had never seen before. The loss of homes was more than two times what the previous record had been. So it was devastating in so many ways to our community. And of course, entire neighborhoods were gone. And so you take a verse like this, the restorer of streets in which to dwell and the repairer of the breach, and it takes on a very practical sort of meaning. The truth is that walls were already broken down before the fires, and there were already streets that needed restoration, if you can hear that. And we're going to talk about that this morning, but God used the event of the fire to quicken something and awaken something and catalyze something. As Doug has been saying in our breakout session, the church serving communities in crisis, never waste a good disaster. This morning, I want us to be thinking in terms of relationship and relationality, if we could. Relationship and relationality. And we'll talk a little bit more about that, but I've learned way more about things like wildfires and other crisis in a community than I ever wanted to know. And not to get lost in this, but those who kind of are studying these things, you know, we are seeing a lot of natural disasters around the world. And maybe we're seeing more of it because the news is making us more aware of those things. But we're also actually seeing just a higher incidence of these things. Certainly in California, that'd be a great example with the fires. And so there's a lot more study. And one of the things that they're looking at is when a similar event happens in two different communities, what's the distinction between how one community recovers from that and how another recovers? So if there's a 6.1 earthquake in Peru, in an area that's very similar to a 6.1 earthquake that happens in Japan, we can look at the recovery process of those two communities and learn something about how a community comes back from that by doing a compare and contrast. And as they've looked at that across the board of different types of disasters and communities and all of that, one of the things that happened is there's been a change of language. And they don't refer to the fire or the tornado or the hurricane as the disaster anymore. They refer to it as the hazard event. I know in the world of political correctness, sometimes we're like, all right, well, you're just playing with words, but there's very something very specific that they're saying there. They're saying this is a destructive event. This is a hazardous event. This has brought a tearing and a breaking in the community. But as they've looked at the distinction of how one community recovers versus another, they've seen that the single most important factor in the recovery of a community is not how much money is available for rebuilding roads or for reimbursing those who lost their homes. It's not the amount of money that's available, but it's actually the quality of relationship within the community that's trying to recover from that disaster. They say the single greatest determiner of the recovery of a community from a destructive event is the quality of the social fabric within that community. And so what they say is that the disaster is determined by the interaction of the destructive event with the social fabric of the community. And so immediately in most of these most of these destructive events that bring chaos into a community, there's this sociological heroic response that happens right away. Walls go down, everyone comes together, everyone's helping, and for a brief moment of time, it looks like heaven has come to that community. And it's not a bad thing. That's the grace of God, actually, that happens in that way. But then you go into a long trough, they call it a season of disillusionment, that can go as long as to at least the 1 year anniversary. And it's during that time of descent into discouragement and disillusionment that the social fabric of that community is tested. And you see the historic challenges between the east part of town and the west part of town, or between particular neighborhoods with other groups, or in the ethnic breakdown of the community. Any of those historic fissures and fractures begin to emerge and become barriers to the recovery of that community, or by God's grace, healing comes into those places and that community becomes stronger on the backside as a result of the response to that event. And so what they say then is that it's the disaster is this interplay between the destructive event and the social fabric in a community, which means that relationality is super important. What happens in the relational fabric? Now, I won't spend a ton of time talking about kings and priests, but just to put in the background, right, the relationality, what I want to encourage in this way, I'll talk in some generalities, but as my dad said, this priestly ministry, right, it brings with it reconciliation, it brings with it connection, and it's very personal. Say personal. It's very personal, right? There's this element of reconciliation and connection in a very personal way. I like to say that Christianity is personal, but it's not private. It's personal, but it's not private. It requires this priestly ministry, the ministry, first and foremost, of our great high priest, Jesus Christ, who purchased us by his blood and reconciled us to our Father in heaven in an extremely personal way. That's why I believe there are no grandchildren in the family of God, right? In that way, it's personal for all of us. As faithful as my parents have been in pursuing God, I do not come into relationship with the Father because they have been faithful in relationship to him. It has to be personal for me. Now hear this, kingship, right? Kingship is corporate. One of the things that's very interesting when you look at, as I was wrestling with the difference between king and lord, right, is that lord in a very real way, I'm not trying to overly confine it, but it speaks to that authority relationship between a lord and an individual. So we say that Jesus is Lord of my life, all right? But kingship is actually a relationship. It is an authority relationship between a king and a people. Kingship creates community. In fact, write this down. Proverbs 14:28, it says this. The glory of a king is his people. The glory of a king is his people. And so we see this dynamic where our inability to really see Jesus as king impacts our ability to really function as a community. I think about this, and I don't want to do damage here to the context, but it's always been interesting to me, the end of the book of Joshua, right? Where in, and it's not that it's a bad thing, but sometimes there's been a tweet for me where he has this beautiful saying, right? And it's wonderful of commitment. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord, which is an awesome declaration. But for me, there's something in that to explore a little bit, right? That there was a wonderful expression of the lordship of Christ in his life and home and family. But we know from what comes next in Judges that something broke down in the corporality of the people, because we go into a place where everyone is doing what's right in their own eyes. There was something that was lost in that relationship between Israel and God as their king, and something broke down with how they functioned as a people. So as we're talking and looking about relationship and relationality, we want to understand that there's something in us seeing Jesus as king and understanding some of the dynamics of the kingdom that will allow us and propel us into our communities in a way that strengthens the social fabric that will allow life to thrive where we live. And so as we went through these fires, we've been given a very, in this community, a very practical, a very personal, but also a very communal lesson in and around this. When the fires hit, we lost 5,100 homes, 3,000 in this city, and entire neighborhoods were gone, and it had everyone's attention, and we knew that our city would never be the same. And the churches came together in wonderful ways to serve. And we just had, I think, you know, I like to say it, that everyone was doing what they could with what they had where they were. And churches truly were lighthouses all over this city. They were shelters and places that were providing clothing and feeding. And you know, some churches were saying, look, if, you know, we know that as we move back to getting to normal, you know, school and that experience is going to be great for the kids. So we'll provide school materials for all the kids who lost their stuff in the fire. And others were saying, all right, we're the church that's going to help mothers with young kids. And we got infant, you know, formula and diapers and all that. So it was beautiful, the coordination and the cooperation and all of those sorts of things. And there was also discussion in the church, and Sonoma County is not the Bible Belt, I'll just say that. We are not the Bible Belt, but we thought that maybe because of the fires, we'd be the Bible Belt, right? And so what we've seen on the news, right, is that in those first couple weeks after a destructive event like this, right, that the churches fill up, right? And so we were saying, all right, and there's this kind of perspective and anticipation, God is going to use these fires to bring the community back to the church. And I got to tell you, we did not even see a bump. But in that was a very important word from God to us. He said, I am not using these fires to bring the community back to the church. I'm using these fires to bring the church back to the community. That's what we've been walking with. That's what we've been going out from. And I'll say, all these things need to be teased out a little bit more, but I'll just say, especially as we're wrestling with the nature, the smallness of how we see as a church, that in terms of bringing Santa Rosa and Sonoma County into God's dream for us, his purpose for us, I'm not so sure that the community coming to the church right now with how the church is going to release those kingdom purposes. Do you understand what I'm saying? To bring the community into the church, there would be something maybe personally that happens, but we don't see the king and the kingdom enough in a way where we'll actually make the community maybe more like the church, but not enough like the kingdom. But when the church gets called out into the community, we get forced to see and work and interact in a different way. We get challenged to see differently, and our rough edges get... Right? There's some people who are hearing me in here right now. It's the grace of God. Because I tell you, if the community started flowing into the church, I promise you, see, we're already faced too inward towards ourselves. And if the community started coming into the church, that would just reinforce that whole element of just taking care of our thing. Because now we just got more to take care of. But God wants us turned out. He wants to teach us something. He wants to do something. And so it was the grace of God that the community didn't flow into the church, because he's trying to bring the church back into the community so we can be repairers of the breach and restorers of the streets in which to dwell. And so we've been on that journey. We've been learning in many different ways. And this morning, I can't focus on all the lessons, but I do want to share a few practical examples of how this works, and to bring us into maybe an encouragement of how this works in our own lives and what we can take back to our own communities. And so just a practical story. We were not prepared for this to happen. We were tremendously benefited by the fact that there's been groups in our community who have been fostering unity among the churches. There's been a meeting that takes place every Wednesday morning for over 25 years of men and women gathering together to pray for this community. And churches cultivating unity. So we had a framework of relationship, though we weren't prepared for what had happened. We had a framework of relationship that created a platform of response for us. But we had no plan. We were just responding, right, to what was going on. And so God, by his grace, the Spirit is just opening doors and doing things. And the stories that I'm going to share from are not... I don't even know all the miracles, but I've talked to a lot of people, and there's a lot of things that happen. The stories I can share are the things that happened in my life, so I don't want to put myself in the wrong place here, but just it'll be personal for all of us. And so I get a call from the assistant superintendent of schools for our city. We went to high school together, and I'd actually... just seen her. My son had been honored as a student of the month for the school district type of thing, and we had reconnected, and so she picks up the phone, and listen here, because it'll make sense a little bit. It's going to connect some dots when we get later in the message. Listen to her heart, right? Public school system. Adam, I'm so concerned for my kids. Did you hear this? For my kids. This was not an institutional call. This was a relational call. Said the schools are going to be shut down for weeks, not days. The schools are going to be shut down for weeks. And the shelters are a terrible place for the kids to be 24/7. This is just not healthy at all. Do you think the church would open its doors to provide free childcare for the children in our community? And by God's grace, he moved on the heart of pastors and leadership teams of churches across this city to say, yes, we will open our doors. We will provide for weeks, not days, weeks, free childcare for the children in our community. And so we did that. And I have to say that the relationship between the churches here in Sonoma County and the public schools in Sonoma County has not actually been all that great historically over the last decade. The attitudes from the church to the schools and from the schools to the church have not always been very awesome. That's an Adam way of saying stuff. Some of you know me, you're like, of course you'd say it that way. So I was blown away when I went to the district website, and when you type in the landing page where you show up at that time, had the names, the very first page had the names of the churches on the district school website that were offering free childcare. And then I'm at a community meeting for the area where my kids go to school. And a woman raises her hand and she says, this was, the fires happened in October. So this is just days after we're coming up. And she says, there's so much trauma, right? But she says, where the neighborhood where my kids have walked door to door every Halloween since they could walk is in ruins. Where am I going to take my kids at Halloween? It was amazing across that room as you saw people's hands go up, bring them to my place, we'll roll out the red carpet for you. But we raised our hands in the city and said, the church is going to roll out the red carpet for families for Halloween. And so, and of course, many had already been planning harvest parties and Halloween parties and all. It was just amazing work of God, right? And so, same thing. The school district sends out a communication to all their families and says, go to church on Halloween. And literally puts the churches on the landing page. Here's some places you can go with your family on Halloween. That just opened the door for more and more. You get this sense, right? Just, all right, look, God, I don't see where this is all going. We're just going to take the next step. You're clearly doing something with schools. This is not a plan that we hatched up. We're just responding. And so we saw that a powerful way to reach families in the immediate moments was to just put together move-in kits as they lost everything they had and they're trying to get established in a new place, just to say, here's some basic kitchen and bedroom and bathroom things. We heard a testimony yesterday that was read from a guy who's done ministry in this community, and you know, just to make it so personal when you feel so alone, and you know, those who lost their homes, you would hear literally them saying, every day I'm remembering something I lost that I hadn't thought of before. This woman wrote about the fact that her first night in a new place that she moved into, she was brought to tears by the fact that she had bought some soup that she was going to heat up and she didn't have a can opener to open it. Another testament, we're in wine country, right? Someone was telling a story. It's just making it really personal, where someone was just wanting to bless someone in the midst of something, and so they handed them a bottle of wine thinking that they were going to do them a great blessing, and it actually triggered a huge emotional reaction back to them, because the person said, I don't even have a bottle opener to open this wine. How out of touch are you with what's going on? And so we put together kitchen and bedroom and bathroom, just a few basics, you know, $100 worth of physical things, right, and $100 worth of gift cards, because my wife said they're going to want to choose their stuff. They don't want you to choose what it's going to look like in their house, right? And we said to the school system, would you identify some teachers and administrators, some people who work there? We want to honor those who are serving our kids and make sure when they come into that new place that they get that welcome home kit. And so we delivered from the churches, school to school, these move-in kits for the teachers and administrators, so they would be edified and built up as they're serving back into the kids and the communities. And the stories just go on and on and on. And God just rolled out the red carpet for us. I remember as this began to go, can you believe this, that this relationship where there had been a lot of division and hostility, that our school district actually created a liaison with the faith community. They said, Adam, we want to give you a relationship of a specific person you can talk with so we can build on this and let that go. And I remember getting a call from this wonderful, godly man who says, Adam, I just heard something really inspiring. There's a school, it's about 10 minutes from here. 120 students at that school, it's a middle school, two grades, 120 students lost their homes. And in this incredible way, they're actually banding together as students. They've self-started a peer-to-peer lunchtime group where those who lost their homes and just get together and have lunch and talk and be together and process. And they said, I'm wondering, do you think the church would be willing to buy lunch for these kids? I said, absolutely not. That's way too much to ask. Duh, right? Of course. Yes, 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 yes. There's 10 churches that would line up to do this, right? But it was so cool. As I would say, you know, one of the closest churches to your school, just right down the street, the pastor there is a retired fireman. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to have lunch brought by fire truck to the kids. And we'll have the first responders serve lunch to the students. And I want to tell you something. Because, man, all our first responders are heroes, but most of them hate the attention that they get. You talk to them and they say, man, I'll show you some heroes on that night. People who don't wear a uniform, they're not getting paid to do it, who save their neighbors' lives and others. And it was so healing for those first responders to actually not be in the place of honor receiving, but just to be able to minister and to honor these kids and what they were doing. It was clearly a repairing of the breach and a restoring of streets in which to dwell at that event, as the church was bringing the first responders to a context of healing and the schools to a context of healing and these kids and their families in that way. And so we began to just say, God, you're doing something. And here's the thing. The further we get from the fires, the easier it is for that momentum, right, to be lost. So we began to pray and say, God, you're doing something in the schools. I don't want to look back a year from now and say, wasn't it amazing what God did with the schools? I want to say, wasn't it amazing the door that God opened so that what happened then has allowed this to be happening now? And so we began to press in to the schools, and it's involved and included. You guys want to hear a little bit more about this? Some simple strategies. I've heard talked about the ministry of presence at different places here today. And I'll say, when we talked about God calling, not calling the community to the church, but the church back to the community, we have a lot of growing to do. And I would say that in this community, we've been overly attracted to shock and awe. And we've undervalued true relationship that builds the social fabric. We've had congregations that have given $10,000 even to a school in need, but not actually done the work to be sitting at the table with them and cultivating that relationship. I'm bringing the distinction forward in a little bit. So we just said, look, I don't think we're capable of really coming in and meeting the needs of most of the schools in our community. They want mentors. They want people who are going to make a commitment to read with children who are struggling with reading in third grade on a weekly basis for 9 months. And I'm not sure we can get five people to make that type of commitment out of our church. I'll tell you one thing. We're not going to overpromise and underdeliver. So I said, here's a novel idea. Let's grow into this. Let's try this. Let's move at the speed of trust in this relationship. Let's move at the speed of trust. God, I believe, gave us a strategy, and we decided we were going to prioritize elementary schools very quickly around that. At least where we are, elementary schools are the most geographically based, so it's not 100%, but generally speaking, elementary schools draw from the neighborhoods immediately surrounding that school, because we recognize we're not trying to reach an institution, we're trying to reach a community. We're trying to reach a group of neighborhoods. And so when you pick an elementary school, you're actually concentrating on a particular part of town. And a congregation near that part of town has the best capacity to really be neighborly to that school. The other thing that is true is that parents at elementary school level tend to be the most involved. You ever see that first day of school to kindergarten? I'm not sure if the kids are walking the parents to school or vice versa. Right? They're all crying. And so you've got that, you've got the, those parent-teacher organizations are truly engaged. And so we've been talking about recognizing it's not just about a good relationship and engagement with the principal. It's how do we engage the parent-teacher organization in a way that weaves us into the social fabric of the community, not just makes us a resource to the institution. And you hear that? It's wonderful that one of the schools that we've adopted, so just to skip forward, we've had, there's about 14 schools in our community that have been adopted by local churches. 12 of them are elementary schools. And one of them recently, the parent-teacher organization was doing a fundraiser, and the church that adopted that school said, we want the parents and kids to be able to eat together and enjoy that morning together, that pancake fundraiser. So don't worry about setup, cleanup, or cooking. The church is going to cook your pancakes for you so you can share a meal and be strong as a community. Incredibly powerful, the doors that that opens. And the last thing, just by simple time, in all elementary schools, you're there for 7 years, kindergarten through sixth grade. There's no other time where you get that much time building into the fabric of a community. So we've launched into the elementary schools, and there's some great examples, but I'll give you a couple just to show you how this is working. One of the schools, it's actually the elementary school closest to my house that's been adopted by a church. That we just started by, at the beginning of the year, bringing donuts and just saying, look, thank you for the way you're investing in the kids in our community. We care about you. We're praying for you. And we hope this is going to be a great year. Now, the first time that the pastors who brought these donuts in to their, they got a, who are you? Oh, that's nice. Leave the donuts there. See you later. There was no applause. There was no, you've changed my life. It's a key thing, right, for us. We've been hearing about the from for distinction, right? They weren't bringing those donuts in for approval, for approbation, for love. They were bringing those in from a place of approval with God, right? From a place of having received his love. So it wasn't about what they got back. But it's a little disheartening sometimes. You wonder, you leave going, all right, was it worth it? Second month, right? Come in. Pretty much the same scenario. They weren't sure that the person even remembered them from the last time they came in. Third month, open the door. As they walk through the door, they hear from across the lobby, you're back! And then they hear from across the lobby, I want you to know that I'm an atheist. And then they heard, but you are my pastors. They keep going, right? They go again. The next time they bring something in, they get an email back from a teacher. She says, I've been teaching at this school for 13 years. I want to say in 13 years, I have never felt so honored and supported by the community. You, in a very difficult time, have made my job and my work so much easier. And then, just 2 weeks ago, we made regional news. I don't know if it was national news, but we made regional news because there was a shooting at one of our shopping malls where a husband, it was a murder-suicide, shot his wife and shot himself. The pastors come in and just bring their, and it's not all about donuts, but this is just a key way that's been for that particular school, but they just come saying, hey, we're here again. They walk in the door and they hear, we are so glad that you're here. We have missed you this week. It is right that you're here. I said, you know that shooting? We've got an 8-year-old student here who lost his mom and his dad. And this has been an incredibly tough week for us. And it means so much that we have you here to walk through us with us. And we're learning something about being repairers of the breach and restorers of streets in which dwell. We're learning something about relationship. We're seeing the distinction. I mean, hear this, because I'm not talking about, there's a lot more, right, when you're starting to invest towards that community. But we're learning there's a difference between giving a $10,000 check and never showing up again and spending $30 or $50 on donuts, but being there on a regular basis. It was like they said, you are part of this. There's a seat at the table for you here. You're part of this with us as we're walking through. We saw another community. I'll just tell one more. There's more, but just one more story about this. Another school, really a very similar pattern, right, where just start by doing a very simple thing. In fact, we've coached them, don't call ahead to the principal and say, we want to do something. Don't create that expectation. Just act, and then let's see what happens as we move forward at the speed of trust. So same type of thing. They bring something for the teachers and thank them and don't really hear anything. And I'm like, hey, how'd it go? I think good. We'll see, you know, and want help. We do it again. And there was that same type of response. And then the phone rings. And this is the thing that's so amazing, right? It's just how God's orchestrating things. And it's the principal of the school. They're talking to the youth pastor who's been the one putting his name and number on just the cards of thanks. And the principal says, I see that you want to help our school. And the youth pastor, like I probably would have been myself, says, yes, I do, and starts rattling off 3 or 4 different things, right, that he wants to do for the school, which is great. I don't think it was offensive in any way. But the principal said, hey, hold up for a second. I have an idea of how you can help us. Right? Is that good? And to spoil the punchline, guess what? The principal's idea was better than any of the ideas that the youth pastor had. Listen to what the principal said. She said, I have got a ton of kids in my school who are hurting. And most of them don't have positive male role models in their lives. And so she said this, would you and the pastor find trusted men, hopefully you, but trusted men in your church, and would you show up at lunchtime and play with my kids on the playground so they can have a positive experience with male role models in their lives? Yeah, that's a very, yeah. That's a, I remember a youth pastor told me, Adam, I didn't think we'd get to this place in the relationship for years. And so they started showing up faithfully every Tuesday. They've done it now since August. Every Tuesday since August, they've showed up and they've played with the kids on the playground. Recently, that youth pastor, just in the last 2 weeks, that youth pastor moved on. And this past Tuesday, a new youth pastor came in with the pastor to go to the school, and the pastor called ahead of time and just let them know that the change was going to be happening. And the person on yard duty, when they walked in, said, hey, just a second, and made him wait because the principal had told her, let me know when they show up because I want to meet the new guy. That's how invested the principal is. And then on the Sunday, God putting an exclamation point on things, a family shows up to this church. And, you know, they go through the service, and after the service, they look at the contact cards, and the family says, we live in the neighborhood, you've been ministering to our kids every week at school, and then they check, I want to receive Jesus, I want to get baptized, this is my home church. I think they were creating new boxes on the card that, moving at the speed of trust. So, I want to, when we're talking about social fabric and I just want to bring in a voice from outside the church, if I can, for a moment here. It's going to take 3 or 4 minutes. But I want to read some excerpts from an article from a gentleman named David Brooks. Anyone here heard of David Brooks before? He writes for the New York Times. He's a sociologist. I am assuming that he's from the outside. You'll see it in some of the language. And yet I want you to hear something about what I'm saying here. Because it's, to me, it's the... Was it the words of the prophets written on the subway walls? Is that how it goes? This article that was written recently in the New York Times is entitled Weavers. And I'm just going to hit some sections of it. You'll get the gist. I start with the pain. A couple of times a week, I give a speech somewhere in the country about social isolation and social fragmentation. Very often, a parent comes up to me afterward and says, my daughter took her life when she was 14, or my son died of an overdose when he was 20. Skipping ahead, what can I say to these parents? What can I say to the parents still around who don't know yet that they may soon become those parents? This kind of pain is an epidemic in our society. He goes on to talk about different variations on the same thing, and he says, these different kinds of pain share a common thread. Our lack of healthy connection to each other, our inability to see the full dignity of each other, and the resulting culture of fear, distrust, tribalism, shaming, and strife. On December 7th, 1941, countless Americans saw that their nation was in peril and walked into recruiting stations. We don't have anything as dramatic as Pearl Harbor, but when 47,000 Americans kill themselves every year and 72,000 more die from drug addiction, isn't that a silent Pearl Harbor? When the basic norms of decency, civility, truthfulness are under threat, isn't that a silent Pearl Harbor? Aren't we all called at moments like these to do something extra? He says, my something extra was starting something 9 months ago at the Aspen Institute called Weave, the Social Fabric Project. The first core idea was that social isolation is the problem underlying a lot of our other problems. The second idea was that this problem is being solved by people around the country, statesmen among us, you're going to love this, at a local level, who are building community and weaving the social fabric. This is a movement that doesn't know it's a movement. He talks about some examples. He says, many do not know that they are weaving in the course of everyday life because this work that they're doing is what neighbors do. He said this. They go into community. We're going to come back to this. He says, we go into neighborhoods and ask, who is trusted here? In one neighborhood, it was the guy who collects the fees at the parking garage. We're living with the excess of 60 years of hyper-individualism. There's a lot of emphasis in our culture on personal freedom, self-interest, self-expression. Think judges here, everyone doing what's right in their own eyes. The idea that life is an individual journey towards personal fulfillment. This is David Brooks. You do you. But weavers share an ethos that puts relationship over self. We are born into relationships, and the measure of our life is in the quality of our relationships. We precedes me. Whether they live in red or blue America, they often use the same terms and embody the same values of deep hospitality, showing up for people, and to keep showing up, this ministry of presence, right? They are somewheres, not anywheres. Hear this pea patch thing, right? My lentil patch. Firmly planted in their local community, he says, I met one guy in Ohio who began his work by standing in the town square with a sign that said, defend Youngstown. One of the things, as he gets testimonies, he heard from one of these weavers identified. She said, we don't do things for people. We don't do things to people. We do things with people. His testimony is this: being around these people has been one of the most uplifting experiences of my life. Obviously, it's made me want to be more neighborly, to be more active and intentional in how I extend care, but it has also changed my moral lens. I've become so impatient with the politicians I cover. They are so self-absorbed. Social scientists tell us that selfishness is natural. People are motivated by money, power, and status, but weavers are not motivated by any of these things. They want to live in right relationship with others to serve the community good. Their example has shown me we don't just have a sociological problem, we have a moral problem. We all create a shared moral ecology through the daily decisions of our lives. I can't believe, man, this is the New York Times, guys. When we stereotype, abuse, impugn motives, and lie about each other, we've ripped the social fabric and encouraged more ugliness. When we love across boundaries, listen patiently, see deeply, and make someone feel known, we've woven it and reinforced generosity. So the big question is, how do we take the success the weavers are having on the local level and make it national? The weavers are building relationships one by one, which takes time. Relationships don't scale. But norms scale. If you can change the culture, you can change behavior on a large scale. If you can change the lens through which someone sees the world, as these weavers have changed mine, then you can change the way people want to be in the world and act in the world. This is the New York Times. And it says this, and I've spent most of my time here, so I'm going to bring it a little less developed maybe to the close, but he says this: we go into a community and we ask, who is trusted here? If someone came into your neighborhood and asked who is trusted here, would they point to your house? And just, let's make it personal. Would they point to your place of business? Would they point to where your congregation meets? I want to challenge us with a thought here. Matthew 10:10, in the first verses of Matthew, he sends his disciples out two by two into the cities. And the basic pattern is he'd send them ahead to where he was going to come. And he gives them all of these instructions about how they're to go, right? They're going to preach. They're going to heal. They're not going to go with a bunch. They're actually going to go in need. They're not bringing the extra gold and tunics. Please help, nod your head up and down. We know what the passage I'm talking about. And he talks then about when you go into a city, and he says, actually says this, in whatever city you go, find out who is worthy, or find the man of peace. Find out, you know what he says? Look for a weaver. Find out who's trusted. And stay at that house. As long as you are there, stay at that house. It's interesting, you know, I've heard it said Jesus never healed a blind man the same way in the Gospels, right? There's places where it's an expression of power, but there doesn't have to be a pattern. But this is a pattern. We actually see this pattern over and over and over. When the gospel is breaking out into the Gentile world past, you know, Peter was at Cornelius, he was at Simon of Joppa's house, right? He was at Simon's house, which represented, he was a tanner, which meant he was perpetually unclean because the work that they did to tan meant that he was dealing with urine and a bunch of other stuff. He kind of went to this border, right? And God in the kingdom is calling them beyond the border, and he brings them to Cornelius' house. Cornelius was a weaver. Cornelius was a trusted one, and he brought him to a house. And it was from the house that the kingdom went forward. You hear that you were brought to a house of a trusted one, of a man of peace, of a weaver. And it was from that house that the kingdom goes into the city. I just want to tell you, it goes over and over. How about the jailer in Philippi and the house? How about this one? As Jesus is on his way, set like a flint for Jerusalem. And the tradition is when and he had a whole throng of people with him. We know how they received him when he got to Jerusalem. The triumphal entry, the people putting down the palm fronds were not the people of Jerusalem. It was the people who had been traveling with him this whole way. Look it up. He had a huge following. He was a man of honor. And as he's getting ready to come into Jericho, we know that culturally the tradition would be that there was a noble person who was expecting to have Jesus stay in his house. Had prepared dinner, had prepared a place, and Jesus is connected. And I'm sure there was anticipation. Maybe the father said, the kingdom is coming to Jericho with you. But he said, I do nothing except what I see the Father doing. I say nothing. So he starts walking in, and maybe someone greets him and says, man, you're going to be at my house. And he just keeps walking. And if we read it right in Luke, he just walked right through the city like, maybe I'm not staying here tonight. And then as he's leaving the city, he sees a little guy up in a tree. And the father says, he doesn't know it yet. Oh, Jesus. He doesn't know it yet. But he's the man of peace for this city. He is the house from which the kingdom of God is going to touch Jericho. And so he says, Zacchaeus, the kingdom comes through a house. I must stay in your house. And Zacchaeus is just overwhelmed by the encounter. He wanted to see Jesus, and he sees Jesus' face. And then he just proclaims the kingdom. He says, there has been injustice. I am not a trusted man in this city. And I've perpetuated injustice. But I want to tell you, justice has come to my house, and the kingdom is going to come to this city through my house. And here's where it starts. I want to tell you, I believe the kingdom of God is going to come to your city through houses. We could break this out. I don't have time, but I want to tell you, the Barnabas role in the church of God is incredibly important. We're so excited, and we should be, because the scripture talks about the foundation of the apostles and the prophets. But Barnabas represents this trusted man, this man of peace, this son of encouragement. And it was Barnabas that was able to go out and bring Paul in and reconcile him and travel with him in a picture from city to city. Barnabas represented the house of a man of peace, from which the apostolic and the kingdom could move into a city. And some of you in here have a Barnabas anointing for your city. I want to challenge you this morning to be looking. You know, there's something here that David Brooks is talking about, and he's recognizing the value of men and women of peace, of those who are trusted in community, of these weavers of the social fabric. We need to keep our eyes out, but for some of you, you are to be that person. You are to be that business owner. You're to be that person in the neighborhood, that person serving at school, where it is. You're to be the one that creates that house, that context of trust, of encouragement, of hospitality, of generosity, something that builds a framework from which the gospel can go into your community. By God's grace, he's making me a man of peace in my city. And I'm grateful that he was faithful, because he wants much more than we could ever look for, that he was faithful in our moment of disaster and crisis, but also opportunity. He didn't flood the community in the church, but he is at work to bring the church into the community, to fill our city with homes, with businesses, with relational groups and network, where the gospel of the kingdom, the life of the kingdom, can flow out. Lord, come to our cities. Use our homes. Use our lives. Use our businesses as a place to release your life, your gospel, your kingdom. In Jesus' name.
This is a copyrighted program of Go Strategic, Santa Rosa, California. Unauthorized reproduction is prohibited. Go Strategic is an international nonprofit organization that educates and equips leaders and others for effective service and leadership using biblical principles. For more information, visit us online at www.gostrategic.org.